and they clashed fiercely with the downworlders. I fought through the crowd to Valentine. My only thought had been of him, that I might be the one to kill him, that I might have that honor. I found him at last by the great statue of the angel, dispatching a fairy knight with the broad stroke of his blood-stained dagger. When he saw me, he smiled, fierce and feral. "A werewolf who fights with a sword and dagger," he said, "is as unnatural as a dog who eats with a fork and a knife." "You know the sword, you know the dagger," I said, "and you know who I am. If you must address me, use my name." "I do not know the names of half-men," said Valentine. "Once I had a friend, a man of honor who would have died before he let his blood be polluted. Now a nameless monster with his face stands before me." He raised his blade. "I should have killed you while I had the chance," he cried, and lunged for me. I parried the blow, and we fought up and down the dais while the battle raged around us, and one by one the members of the circle fell. I saw the Lightwoods drop their weapons and flee. Hodge was already gone, having fled at the outset. And then I saw Jocelyn racing up the stairs toward me, her face a mask of fear. "Valentine, stop!" she cried out. "This is Luke, your friend, almost your brother." With a snarl, Valentine seized her and dragged her in front of him, his dagger to her throat. I dropped my blade. I would not risk his harming her. He saw what was in my eyes. "You always wanted her," he hissed, "and now the two of you have plotted my betrayal together. You will regret what you have done all the rest of your lives." With that, he snatched the locket from Jocelyn's throat and hurled it at me. The silver cord burned me like a lash. I screamed and fell back, and in that moment he vanished into the melee, dragging her with him. I followed, burned and bleeding, but he was too fast, cutting a path through the thick of the crowd and over the dead. I staggered out into the moonlight. The hall was burning and the sky was lit with fire. I could see all down the green lawns of the capital to the dark river and the road along the riverbank where people were fleeing into the night. I found Jocelyn by the banks of the river at last. Valentine was gone and she was terrified for Jonathan, desperate to get home. We found a horse and she plunged away. Dropping into wolf form, I followed at her heels. Wolves are fast, but a rested horse is faster. I fell far behind, and she arrived at the manor house before I did. I knew, even as I neared the house, that something was terribly wrong. Here, too, the smell of fire hung heavy in the air, and there was something overlaying it, something thick and sweet, the stench of demonic witchcraft. I became a man again as I limped up the long drive, white in the moonlight, like a river of silver leading to ruins. For the manor house had been reduced to ashes. Layer upon layer of sifting whiteness strewn across the lawns by the night wind. Only the foundations, like burned bones, were still visible. Here a window, there a leaning chimney. But the substance of the house, the bricks and the mortar, the priceless books and ancient tapestries handed down through generations of shadow hunters, were dust blowing across the face of the moon. Valentine had destroyed the house with demon fire. He must have. No fire of this world burns so hot nor leaves so little behind. I made my way into the still smoldering ruins. I found Jocelyn kneeling on what had perhaps once been the front doorsteps. They were blackened by fire. And there were bones, charred to blackness but recognizably human, with scraps of cloth here and there and bits of jewelry the fire had not taken. Red and gold threads still clung to the bones of Jocelyn's mother, and the heat had melted her father's dagger to his skeletal hand. Among another pile of bones gleamed Valentine's silver amulet, with the insignia of the circle still burning white-hot upon its face, and among the remains, scattered as if they were too fragile to hold together, were the bones of a child. "You will regret what you have done," Valentine had said. And as I knelt with Jocelyn on the burned paving stones, I knew that he was right. I did regret it, and have regretted it every day since. We rode back through the city that night, among the still-burning fires and shrieking people, and then out into the darkness of the country. It was a week before Jocelyn spoke again. I took her out of Idris. We fled to Paris. We had no money, but she refused to go to the Institute there and ask for help. She was done with shadow hunters, she told me. Done with the shadow world. I sat in the tiny, cheap hotel room we had rented and tried to reason with her, but it did no good. She was obstinate. At last, she told me why. She was carrying another child and had known it for weeks. She would make a new life for herself and her baby, and she wanted no whisper of clave or covenant ever to taint her future. She showed me the amulet she had taken from the pile of bones. In the flea market at Clignancourt, she sold it, and with that money purchased an airplane ticket. She wouldn't tell me where she was going. The farther away she could get from Idris, she said, the better. I knew that leaving her old life behind meant leaving me behind as well, and I argued with her, but to no avail. I knew that if not for the child she carried, she would have taken her own life, and since to lose her to the mundane world was better than to lose her to death, I at last reluctantly agreed to her plan. And so it was that I bid her goodbye at the airport. The last words Jocelyn spoke to me in that dreary departure hall chilled me to the bone. Valentine is not dead. After she was gone, I returned to my pack, but I found no peace there. Always there was a hollow aching inside me, and always I woke up with her name unspoken on my lips. I was not the leader I had once been, I knew that much. I was just and fair, but remote. I could not find friends among the wolf people, nor a mate. I was, in the end, too much human, too much shadow hunter, to be at rest among the lycanthropes. I hunted, but the hunt brought no satisfaction, and when it came time for the accords to be signed at last, I went into the city to sign them. In the Hall of the Angel, scrubbed free of blood, the shadow hunters and the four branches of half-humans sat down again to sign the papers that would bring peace among us. I was astonished to see the Lightwoods, who seemed equally astonished that I wasn't dead. They themselves, they said, along with Hodge Starkweather and Michael Wayland, were the only members of the former circle to have escaped death that night in the hall. Michael, racked with grief over the loss of his wife, had hidden himself away at his country estate with his young son. The Clave had punished the other three with exile. They were leaving for New York to run the Institute there. The Lightwoods, who had connections to the highest families in the Clave, got off with a far lighter sentence than Hodge. A curse had been laid on him. He would go with them, but if ever he were to leave the hallowed ground of the Institute, he would be instantly slain. He was devoting himself to his studies, they said, and would make a fine tutor for their children. When we signed the accords, I rose from my chair and went from the hall down to the river where I had found Jocelyn on the night of the uprising. Watching the dark waters flow, I knew I could never find peace in my homeland. I had to be with her or nowhere at all. I determined to look for her. I left my pack, naming another in my stead. I think they were relieved to see me go. I traveled as the wolf without a pack travels, alone, at night, keeping to the byways and country roads. I went back to Paris, but found no clue there. Then I went to London. From London, I took a boat to Boston. I stayed a while in the cities, then in the white mountains of the frozen north. I traveled a good deal, but more and more I found myself thinking of New York and the exiled shadow hunters there. Jocelyn, in a way, was an exile too. At length, I arrived in New York with a single duffel bag and no idea where to look for your mother. It would have been easy enough for me to find a wolf pack and join it, but I resisted. As I had done in other cities, I sent out messages through Downworld, searching for any sign of Jocelyn, but there was nothing, no word at all, as if she had simply disappeared into the mundane world without a trace. I began to despair. In the end, I found her by chance. I was prowling the streets of Soho randomly. As I stood on the cobblestones of Broome Street, a painting hanging in a gallery window caught my eye. It was the study of a landscape I recognized immediately. The view from the windows of her family's manor house, the green lawns sweeping down to the line of trees that hid the road beyond. I recognized her style, her brushwork, everything. I banged on the door of the gallery, but it was closed and locked. I returned to the painting, and this time I saw the signature. It was the first time I had seen her new name, Jocelyn Frey. By that evening, I had found her living in a fifth-floor walk-up in that artist's haven, the East Village. I walked up the grimy, half-lit stairs with my heart in my throat and knocked on her door. It was opened by a little girl with dark red braids and inquisitive eyes. And then, behind her, I saw Jocelyn walking toward me, her hands stained with paint, and her face just the same as it had been when we were children. The rest you know. 22. Renwick's Ruin. For a long moment after Luke finished speaking, there was silence in the room. The only sound was the faint drip of water down the stone walls. Finally, he said, "Say something, Clary." "What do you want me to say?" He sighed. "Maybe that you understand?" Clary could hear the blood pounding in her ears. She felt as if her life had been built on a sheet of ice as thin as paper, and now the ice was beginning to crack, threatening to plunge her into the icy darkness below. Down into the dark water, she thought, where all her mother's secrets drifted in the currents, the forgotten remains of a shipwrecked life. She looked up at Luke. He seemed wavering, indistinct, as if she looked through a blurred glass. "My father," she said. "That picture my mother always kept on the mantle?" "That wasn't your father," said Luke. "Did he ever even exist?" Clary's voice rose. "Was there ever a John Clark, or did my mother make him up too?" "John Clark existed, but he wasn't your father. He was the son of two of your mother's neighbors when you lived in the East Village. He died in a car crash, just like your mother told you, but she never knew him. She had his photo because the neighbors commissioned her to paint a portrait of him in his army uniform. She gave them the portrait but kept the photo and pretended the man in it had been your father. I think she thought it was easier that way. After all, if she'd claimed he'd run off or disappeared, you'd have wanted to look for him. A dead man won't contradict your lies," Clary finished for him bitterly. "Didn't she think it was wrong? All those years letting me think my father was dead when my real father..." Luke said nothing, letting her find the end of the sentence herself, letting her think the unthinkable thought on her own. "Is Valentine..." Her voice shook. "That's what you're telling me, right? That Valentine was... is my father?" Luke nodded, his knotted fingers the only sign of the tension he felt. "Yes." "Oh, my God!" Clary leaped to her feet, no longer able to sit still. She paced to the bars of the cell. "That's not possible. It's just not possible. Clary, please don't get upset. Don't get upset! You're telling me that my dad is a guy who's basically an evil overlord, and you want me to not get upset?"
"He wasn't evil to begin with," Luke said, sounding almost apologetic.
"Oh, I beg to differ. I think he was clearly evil. All that stuff he was spouting about keeping the human race pure and the importance of untainted blood, he was like one of those creepy white power guys, and you two totally fell for it."
"I wasn't the one talking about slimy downworlders just minutes ago," Luke said quietly. "Or about how they couldn't be trusted."
"That's not the same thing."
Clary could hear the tears in her voice.
"I had a brother," she went on, her voice catching. "Grandparents, too. They're dead?"
Luke nodded, looking down at his big hands open on his knees. "They're dead."
"Jonathan," she said softly. "He would have been older than me. A year older?"
Luke said nothing.
"I always wanted a brother," she said.
"Don't," he said wretchedly. "Don't torture yourself. You can see why your mother kept all this from you, can't you? What good would it have done you to know what you had lost before you were even born?"
"That box," Clary said, her mind working feverishly.
With the JC on it. Jonathan Christopher. That's what she was always crying over. That was his lock of hair. My brother's, not my father's.
Yes.
And when you said, Clary isn't Jonathan, you meant my brother. My mom was so overprotective of me because she'd already had one child who died.
Before Luke could reply, the cell door clanged open and Gretel entered. The healing kit, which Clary had been envisioning as a hard, plastic-sided box with the Red Cross insignia on it, turned out to be a big wooden tray stacked with folded bandages, steaming bowls of unidentified liquids, and herbs that gave off a pungent, lemony odor. Gretel set the tray down beside the cot and gestured for Clary to sit down, which she did unwillingly.
"That's a good girl," said the wolf woman, dipping a cloth into one of the bowls and lifting it to Clary's face.
Gently, she cleaned away the dried blood.
"What happened to you?"
she asked disapprovingly, as if she suspected Clary of taking a cheese grater to her face.
"I was wondering that myself," said Luke, watching the goings-on with folded arms.
"Hugo attacked me." Clary tried not to wince as the astringent liquid stung her wounds.
"Hugo?" Luke blinked.
"Hodge's bird. I think it was his bird, anyway. Maybe it was Valentine's."
"Hugin," Luke said softly. "Hugin and Munin were Valentine's pet birds. Their names mean thought and memory."
"Well, they should mean attack and kill," said Clary. "Hugo almost tore my eyes out."
"That's what he's trained to do."
Luke was tapping the fingers of one hand against his other arm.
"Hodge must have taken him in after the uprising. But he'd still be Valentine's creature."
"Just like Hodge was," Clary said, wincing as Gretel cleaned the long slash along her arm, which was crusted with dirt and dried blood. Then Gretel began bandaging it up neatly.
"Clary, I don't want to talk about the past anymore," she said fiercely. "I want to know what we're going to do now. Now Valentine's got my mom, Jace, and the cup, and we've got nothing."
"I wouldn't say we have nothing," said Luke. "We have a powerful wolf pack. The problem is that we don't know where Valentine is."
Clary shook her head. Lank strings of hair fell into her eyes, and she tossed them back impatiently. God, she was filthy. The one thing she wanted more than anything else, almost anything else, was a shower.
"Doesn't Valentine have some kind of hideout? A secret lair?"
"If he does," said Luke, "he has kept it secret indeed." Gretel released Clary, who moved her arm gingerly. The greenish ointment Gretel had smeared on the cut had minimized the pain, but the arm still felt stiff and wooden.
"Wait a second," Clary said.
"I never understand why people say that," Luke said to no one in particular. "I wasn't going anywhere."
"Could Valentine be somewhere in New York?"
"Possibly."
"When I saw him at the Institute, he came through a portal. Magnus said there are only two portals in New York, one at Dorothea's and one at Renwick's. The one at Dorothea's was destroyed, and I can't really see him hiding out there anyway, so..."
"Renwick's?" Luke looked baffled. "Renwick isn't a shadow hunter name."
"What if Renwick isn't a person, though?" said Clary.
"What if it's a place? Renwick's, like a restaurant or a hotel or something."
Luke's eyes went suddenly wide. He turned to Gretel, who was advancing on him with the medical kit.
"Get me a phone book," he said.
She stopped in her tracks, holding the tray out toward him in an accusatory manner.
"But, sir, your wounds."
"Forget my wounds and get me a phone book," he snapped. "We're in a police station. You'd think there'd be plenty of old ones around."
With a look of disdainful exasperation, Gretel set the tray down on the ground and marched out of the room. Luke looked at Clary over his spectacles, which had slid partway down his nose.
"Good thinking."
She didn't reply. There was a hard knot at the center of her stomach. She found herself trying to breathe around it. The beginning of a thought tickled at the edge of her mind, wanting to resolve itself into a full-blown realization. But she pushed it firmly down and away. She couldn't afford to give her resources, her energy, to anything but the issue immediately at hand. Gretel returned with damp-looking yellow pages and thrust them at Luke. He read the book standing up while the wolf woman attacked his injured side with bandages and sticky pots of ointment.
There are 7 Renwicks in the phone book, he said finally. No restaurants, hotels, or other locations. He pushed his spectacles up. They slid down again instantly. They are not shadow hunters, he said, and it seems unlikely to me that Valentine would set up headquarters in the home of a mundane or a downworlder. Though, perhaps... Do you have a phone? Clary interrupted.
Not on me.
Luke, still holding the phone book, peered under it at Gretel.
Could you get the telephone?
With a disgusted snort, she tossed the wad of bloody cloths she'd been holding onto the floor and stalked out of the room a second time. Luke set the phone book down on the table, picked up the roll of bandaging, and began winding it around the diagonal cut across his ribs.
Sorry, he said as Clary stared. I know, it's disgusting.
If we catch Valentine, she asked abruptly, can we kill him? Luke nearly dropped the bandages.
What?
She fiddled with a stray thread poking out of the pocket of her jeans. He killed my older brother. He killed my grandparents, didn't he? Luke set the bandages on the table and pulled his shirt down.
And you think killing him will what? Erase those things?
Gretel returned before Clary could say anything to that. She wore a martyred expression and handed Luke a clunky-looking old-fashioned cell phone. Clary wondered who paid the phone bills. Clary held her hand out. Let me make a call. Luke seemed hesitant. Clary, it's about Renwick's. It'll only take a second. He handed her the phone warily. She punched in the number and half turned away from him to give herself the illusion of privacy. Simon picked up on the third ring.
Hello?
It's me. His voice climbed an octave.
Are you all right?
I'm fine. Why? Have you heard anything from Isabel?
No. What would I have heard from Isabel? Is there something wrong? Is it Alec?
No, Clary said, not wanting to lie and say that Alec was fine. It's not Alec. Look, I just need you to Google something for me. Simon snorted.
You're kidding.
Don't they have a computer there? You know what? Don't answer that. She heard the sounds of a door opening and the thump meow as Simon's mother's cat was banished from his perch on the keyboard of his computer. She could picture Simon quite clearly in her head as he sat down, his fingers moving quickly over the keyboard.
What do you want me to look up?
She told him. She could feel Luke's worried eyes on her as she talked. It was the same way he'd looked at her when she was 11 years old and had the flu with the spiking fever. He brought her ice cubes to suck on and had read to her out of her favorite books doing all the voices.
You're right, Simon said, snapping her out of her reverie. It's a place, or at least it was a place. It's abandoned now.
Her sweaty hand slipped on the phone and she tightened her grip.
Tell me about it.
The most famous of the lunatic asylums, debtors' prisons, and hospitals built on Roosevelt Island in the 1800s. Simon read dutifully. Renwick Smallpox Hospital was designed by architect Jacob Renwick and intended to quarantine the poorest victims of Manhattan's uncontrollable smallpox epidemic. During the next century, the hospital was abandoned to disrepair. Public access to the ruin is forbidden.
Okay, that's enough, said Clary, her heart pounding. That's got to be it. Roosevelt Island. Don't people live there?
Not everyone lives in the slope, princess, said Simon with a fair degree of mock sarcasm. Anyway, do you need me to give you a ride again or something?
No, I'm fine. I don't need anything. I just wanted the information.
All right.
He sounded a little hurt, Clary thought, but told herself it didn't matter. He was safe at home, and that was what was important. She hung up, turning to Luke. There's an abandoned hospital at the south end of Roosevelt Island called Renwick's. I think Valentine's there. Luke shoved his glasses up again.
Blackwell's Island.
Of course. What do you mean, Blackwell's? I said, he cut her off with a gesture.
That's what Roosevelt Island used to be called. Blackwell's. It was owned by an old shadow hunter family, I should have guessed.
He turned to Gretel. Get Alaric. We're going to need everyone back here as soon as possible. His lips were curled into a half-smile that reminded Clary of the cold grin Jace wore during fights. Tell them to ready themselves for battle. They made their way up to the street via a circuitous maze of cells and corridors that eventually opened out into what had once been the lobby of a police station. The building was abandoned now, and the slanting light of late afternoon cast strange shadows over the empty desks, the padlocked cabinets pocked with black termite holes, the cracked floor tiles spelling out the motto of the NYPD, Fidelis ad mortem. "Faithful unto death," said Luke, following her gaze. "Let me guess," said Clary. "On the inside, it's an abandoned police station. From the outside, mundanes only see a condemned apartment building or a vacant lot or..." "Actually, it looks like a Chinese restaurant from the outside," Luke said. "Takeout only, no table service."
"A Chinese restaurant?" Clary echoed in disbelief.
He shrugged.
"Well, we are in Chinatown. This was the second precinct building once. People must think it's weird that there's no phone number to call for orders."
Luke grinned.
"There is. We just don't answer it much. Sometimes, if they're bored, some of the cubs will deliver someone some mooshu pork."
"You're kidding."
"Not at all. The tips come in handy."
He pushed the front door open, letting in a stream of sunlight. Still not sure whether he was kidding or not, Clary followed Luke across Baxter Street to where his car was parked. The inside of the pickup truck was comfortingly familiar. The faint smell of wood chips and old paper and soap, the faded pair of plush gold dice that she'd given him when she was 10 because they looked like the gold dice hanging from the rearview mirror of the Millennium Falcon, the discarded gum wrappers and empty coffee cups rolling around on the floor. Clary hauled herself up into the passenger seat, settling back against the headrest with a sigh. She was more tired than she would have liked to admit. Luke shut the door after her. "Stay right here." She watched as he talked to Gretel and Alaric, who were standing on the steps of the old police station waiting patiently. Clary amused herself by letting her eyes fade in and out of focus, watching the glamour appear and disappear. First, it was an old police station. Then it was a dilapidated storefront sporting a yellow awning that read Jade Wolf Chinese Cuisine. Luke was gesturing to his second and third, pointing down the street. His pickup was the first in a line of vans, motorcycles, jeeps, and even a wrecked-looking old school bus. The vehicle stretched in a line down the block and around the corner, a convoy of werewolves. Clary wondered how they'd begged, borrowed, stolen, or commandeered so many vehicles on such short notice. On the plus side, at least they wouldn't all have to go on the aerial tram. Luke accepted a white paper bag from Gretel and, with a nod, bounded back to the pickup. Folding his lanky body behind the wheel, he handed her the bag. "You're in charge of this." Clary peered at it suspiciously. "What is it? Weapons?" Luke's shoulders shook with soundless laughter. "Steamed bao buns, actually," he said, pulling the truck out into the street, "and coffee." Clary ripped the bag open as they headed uptown, her stomach growling furiously. She tore a bun apart, savoring the rich, savory salt taste of the pork, the chewiness of the white dough. She washed it down with a swig of black, super sweet coffee and offered a bun to Luke. "Want one?"
"Sure."
It was almost like old times, she thought, as they swung onto Canal Street, when they had picked up bags of hot dumplings from the Golden Carriage Bakery and eaten half of them on the drive home over the Manhattan Bridge.
"So, tell me about this Jace," said Luke.
Clary nearly choked on a bun. She reached for the coffee, drowning her coughs with hot liquid.
"What about him?
Do you have any idea what Valentine might want with him?"
"No."
Luke frowned into the setting sun.
"I thought Jace was one of the Lightwood kids."
"No." Clary bit into a third bun. "His last name is Wayland. His father was..."
"Michael Wayland?"
She nodded. "And when Jace was 10 years old, Valentine killed him. Michael, I mean."
"That sounds like something he would do," said Luke.
His tone was neutral, but there was something in his voice that made Clary look at him sideways.
Did he not believe her?
"Jace saw him die," she added, as if to bolster her claim.
"That's awful," said Luke. "Poor messed up kid."
They were driving over the 59th Street Bridge. Clary glanced down and saw the river turned all to gold and blood by the setting sun. She could glimpse the south end of Roosevelt Island from here, though it was just a smudge to the north.
He's not so bad, she said. The Lightwoods have taken good care of him.
I can imagine. They were always close with Michael, observed Luke, swerving into the left lane,